With some of the family, I've sought to understand them better in order to get near enough to kill them. With Bryony, her entire life is lived online. I can see it all. There's just not much to it. Normally, the wealthiest people, I have learnt, don't want to be on any annual rich lists. They don't want to live in the spotlight where normal people know what they have and where they go. If the Artemis clan were like that, my job would have been infinitely harder. That awful phrase, money talks, wealth whispers, comes to mind. Happily, Bryony doesn't just want to talk, she wants to scream. Specifically on Instagram, all the time. Those dreary predictions everyone makes as though it's original and not just an episode of some dystopian Netflix series about the bleak future where we're all just existing through our phones, that's actually Bryony's life. As the manicurist rubbed oil into her hands and signalled that she was all done, Bryony lifted her head as though it was a tremendous effort and inspected her nails. She took an inordinate amount of time checking each individual finger before sitting up straight in her chair and laughing. Not a cheerful laugh, but one meant to signal absolute derision. She crinkled her eyebrows and fixed a stare on the woman sitting across from her. "You've ripped my cuticles. All of them. Are you qualified to do this? No, really, I mean it. How did you manage to damage every single cuticle? Did you use a crowbar?" The manicurist frantically gestured to her manager, either stunned into silence or lacking the right vocabulary to respond in kind. The salon had hushed in seconds, everyone deliberately not looking at Bryony, but staying stock still in order to hear what was happening. Normally, this kind of attention might make someone pull back, but Bryony clearly had very little sense of embarrassment. There's a theory about Eton, that it doesn't produce the cleverest boys, but it does produce the most confident. That's why all these mediocre Pillsbury doughboys with a nervous system feel as though they're more than capable of giving being Prime Minister a shot. That's what you pay for. Bryony had that kind of confidence. She could behave terribly and not give a flying fuck. The manager came over and ushered Bryony to the reception desk, clearly aware that this was a customer ready to make a scene and eager to get her away from other paying clients. But it was no use. Bryony had a voice that carried and she used it to full effect. "This is just embarrassing. Are you telling me that you're happy to let customers leave your salon with ragged nails? I was told that this place was good, but my friend must have been drunk, as per, because I've never had such a terrible manicure. I have a video to shoot later. Am I expected to show my hands on camera like this?" The manager was making calming sounds. I imagine offers were being made, apologies given. I shouldn't have to tell you that there was nothing wrong with her nails, now should I? They looked fine. Good, even. This was just a bored young woman wielding power because dissatisfaction is currency in a way that kindness is not. "It goes without saying that I'm not paying for this." Bryony wasn't even looking at the woman. She was browsing the nail varnishes on display. "And I'll take this colour home with me for when my nails inevitably chip within hours. You're lucky I'm not going to put this all on my social channels." And with that, she grabbed a bottle of varnish and walked out, the door slamming behind her. Listener, she did put it on her social media channels. I've told you that there wasn't much to know about Bryony, and that's true. Waters didn't run deep with that one. As far as I can tell, she wasn't exactly stupid, but she just never had to be smart. She lived a very nice life with everything she ever wanted, and as a result, she wasn't very nice. I'd go further, actually. She appeared to be a total cunt. A great word. It can be enunciated in several different ways to convey varying ferocity, and it perfectly encapsulates so many people. I can't dance around the truth, calling people disagreeable or unbecoming. Jane Austen could conjure up a put-down withering enough to leave you breathless without resorting to profanity, but then she didn't end up in Limehouse. If she had, I imagine Wickham might have been called worse than merely idle and frivolous. Perhaps I should have got to know her better. Some people might wonder why I judged her almost entirely on her online presence, when it's pretty universally understood that nobody is their true selves on the internet. This murder, more than the others, might make one feel increasingly uneasy. I understand killing the rotten old grandparents, but this girl is so young. They probably have more in common than that which divides them. But this is not a story about reconnecting with family. This is not a tale where anyone finds out that they have a whole bunch of relatives waiting to embrace them, and I am not a damaged bird who desperately wants such shelter. What I want is these people gone. With apologies to Elizabeth I, I have no interest at all in making windows into these people's souls, or exploring the lack of them. Bryony still lived at home. I guess when you live in a house that has 16 bedrooms and 2 staircases, you can pretend to yourself that you're living alone in some way. I assume she occupied a floor, or a wing if the Artemis McMansion has such pretensions. But still, she lived at home as an adult. Since she had done a jewellery design course in London and turned down the experience of a true uni life, she never moved out. Not once. Her parents bought her a Chelsea Mews house when she turned 21, but she never spent more than a couple of nights there. Instead, she held parties there for the young and beautiful, but always returned to the family enclave. Does that say anything about her character to you? Again, maybe I'm looking for meaning where there is none. But rejecting all the potential that the adult world offers seems like a waste. And staying near your parents when your parents are Janine and Simon Artemis seems like a real personality red flag. Bryony did not have a partner, or at least not one that she talked about. I took this to mean she was single, since her previous love interests were featured heavily on social media and also in the society pages. She referred to herself as pansexual, but only seemed to have dated men. Sure. There was a small dog which featured heavily in her life at one point, and then, well, didn't. Much was made of this, and the hashtag #WhereIsFendi trended for a while on Twitter, forcing her to admit that she'd given the dog to her personal trainer because of unforeseen anger issues. The dog's, not hers. She had a million friends, but no friends. There were photographs of her on the town with other rich, nothing-eyed women, cheek to cheek, but never actually touching. But most of her images were of her alone, looking in the mirror, pretending to react to an imaginary photographer. Bryony didn't have a job. Sure, she'd dabbled in modelling. I don't mean high fashion, I mean one season being a brand ambassador for an old British design house, grown fusty and desperately looking to get a profile boost on the society pages. The other ambassadors included the son of an ageing rock star and a minor royal, one minor enough not to look anything like Prince Andrew. But she never did a job that would surprise you. That daughter of a millionaire? Oh, she works in her local estate agent, really knuckling down trying to work her way up. No, of course not. She had a singular low moment when it was announced that she was going to design an exclusive range of embellished headbands for Sassy Girl, and someone in the PR department, clearly desperate not to get fired, took the bold step of describing her as a gemstone artiste in the promo material. Do you blame the newspapers for digging up her brief stint, read 6 weeks, on a jewellery design course and christening her Daddy's Diamante? Still, Bryony is nothing if not completely immune to criticism. You cannot keep an overly privileged white girl down. She might not need a full-time job, but in a world where women are constantly exhorted to be a girl boss, she had to do something to justify her life of handbags and back-to-back exercise classes. She briefly went to a members-only studio in Mayfair called the SS Collective, which stood for the Slim Strong Collective, but really served to show us all that history is not adequately taught in our schools. So Bryony did what any less than self-respecting person does in the modern age. She became an influencer. A lot of people might not know what that is. There's no reason to be smugly proud about such a lack of knowledge. The only thing worse than someone who enthusiastically devours all pop culture and spews it up, wearing a t-shirt that says we should all be feminists while queuing up for 45 minutes to buy the latest trainers made by women in a sweatshop, is someone who takes pride in not understanding new trends. You're not better than that. You don't get points for deliberately trying to avoid learning about what's happening around you, and you've almost certainly looked at the mail online in the past month, so cut the smug. An influencer is someone who has a large social media presence and uses that to endorse brands for money. No different from the heady days of the 90s when big-name actors would hawk toothpastes in other countries for megabucks. Well, except that this new group isn't famous for anything but their influencing. There is no talent that lies behind it, no singing or art or writing that gave them a springboard to start flogging stuff. It's usually just thin white women, or bulky white men, who have preternaturally bright smiles and unnerving beige homes, all the better to photograph tat in, and who try to convince the minions that they possess a lifestyle that others should desperately try to emulate. Usually the influencer also bangs on about gratitude or living in the moment, and pretends they've suffered from mild anxiety or struggle with some unspecific hardship in order to present as more relatable. The platitudes that gush from these people could overpower the Thames barrier. Watching some of this stuff will make you wish that it would. So it was a perfect job for Bryony. Job is possibly a stretch. It was a perfect fit for Bryony. She made video diaries which detailed her day-to-day activities. One video, with 180,000 views, revolved entirely around a trip to the osteopath, and posted photographs of herself in various bored-looking poses using a variety of props and backgrounds. By props, I mean her stupidly fluffy carpet, her mirror wall, and her walk-in wardrobe. By backgrounds, I'm talking about exclusive holiday locations, often accompanied by hashtags which suggest that she's desperately in need of a break. Hashtag needed this. As if the carousel of facials, gym classes, and nightclubs was leaving her dangerously close to burnout. I can only imagine that her loyal followers, many of them presumably earning crappy wages and on 0 hours contracts, would nod in sympathy and praise her sensible prioritising of self-care. She interspersed photos of such holidays with sponsored posts which looked just like the rest of her feed. These adverts were supposed to show you how to be a bit more Bryony. Tooth whitening kits, flimsy dresses available for next day delivery, a plated ring with her initials that she described as a must-have. This stuff is gobbled up by the Instagram herd, keen to fit in, desperate to be told what's good, what works, what will distract them from their lives. But it's all a trick. Bryony was laughing at them, or she would have had she been able to take joy from anything in her life. Perhaps not laughing, but sneering. Because if my half-sister wanted her teeth whitened, she'd go to the best dentist on Harley Street. And if she wanted a new dress, she'd put down £1,000 and have it delivered in a tissue-lined box by courier within the hour. Her jewellery would never leave a green mark on her finger. It's all from Cartier. The stuff she promotes is photographed, uploaded, and then discarded. I could just about imagine that she gives it to the family housekeeper, but could equally believe that it goes straight in the bin. Her lifestyle disgusted me and fascinated me in equal measure. Well, no, that's not quite true. It fascinated me more. I have spent hours of my life scrolling through her curated online life, watching her boring makeup videos and logging on for her live Q&A sessions, where she spends 15 minutes at 7 p.m, nightly answering hard-hitting questions from fans like, "How is your hair so shiny?" Which she answers with the intensity and seriousness of someone testifying at a war crimes tribunal. While the internet is a place to get closer to your heroes, it's also a place to obsessively hate-watch people you would try your best to avoid in real life. I always told myself that it was valuable research, but engaging with it for so long leaves you feeling demoralised and dirty. It's like repeatedly picking at a scab and wondering why you end up with an ugly scar. Bryony's openness on social media had provided me with a lot of options. I had too many. I fell down scenarios of such complexity that at one point I was researching how quickly I could get a helicopter pilot license. I had to reassess. While not all of my plans had been elegant, they had been effective. Sometimes the lack of style bothered me somewhat. Who doesn't want to dispatch someone with a bit of wit, after all? But it would be the height of vanity to centre all my fragile plans around the visuals of the situation. And vanity can get you caught. Just ask the many killers who end up in jail because they hang around the crime scene to admire their handiwork and attract obvious attention. As it happens, the plan I settled on did have an element of humour to it. There's one other thing I knew about Bryony, and initially, I almost wrote it off as something she'd exaggerated for effect. All social media influencers try to show some minor vulnerability. It helps the brand. Some pretend they have a palatable mental illness, as I mentioned. Anxiety often works, never psychosis. Some bang on about ailments like Lyme disease or a chronic pain so vague that nobody can disprove it. Bryony cast her net for something new. A while back, she did a very personal, you knew it was serious because she was wearing a plain black jumper and minimal makeup, video about a recent diagnosis that had shaken her world. Trembling, she spoke directly to camera, explaining that after an evening at Vardo, a restaurant that had recently opened to much fanfare in Chelsea, she'd collapsed and stopped breathing. After extensive tests, the culprit had been revealed, and she could never eat a peach again. There were tears, for peaches were her very favourite. When I watched this tale of tragedy, I rolled my eyes and moved on. But she didn't stop with her PSAs about the dangers of stone fruits. The National Food Allergy Trust got in touch with her, and Bryony found a little cause that would make her look civic-minded and serious. She held a gala evening to raise money for research, roping in fashion designers to donate looks to a catwalk event where she and her friend sashayed through a room in the British Museum, draping themselves around marble statues and posing next to ancient sarcophagi. If there wasn't a Pharaoh's curse before, there damn well is now. Every so often, she'd tell her followers to be mindful of friends with allergies, a service only slightly undermined by the fact that she'd teamed up with a private allergy testing company and recommended their £79 testing kit so that you too could see if a seemingly innocent fruit trifle might kill you. Hashtag ad. Her feed soon filled up with photos of couture and sunsets, and I'd half forgotten her stone fruit crusade until one night when she live-streamed an A&E visit. To be fair, even with a filter, she did look dreadful. Eyes swollen up, blotchy skin, rasping as she whispered to camera about how she'd had to have 3 shots of adrenaline after she'd stopped breathing in a nightclub. Someone had given her a cocktail, blithely assuring her that it was peach-free, and she'd gulped it down, before immediately recognising that tangy taste and running for the exit in wild panic. Because her friends were idiots, or more tragically, perhaps because they didn't really know her, nobody put two and two together and realised that she was having a serious allergic reaction. Instead, one bouncer assumed she was having a panic attack and the other suspected she was just drunk. It was only when she turned purple and hit the floor that an ambulance was called. I wonder if the experience of an NHS A&E was almost more traumatic for Bryony than the episode itself. She was on a public ward with only a curtain for privacy, as she whispered into the camera about how scared she felt. Not because she nearly died, but because a drunk man covered in blood in the bed next to her wouldn't stop singing a Bowie song. She didn't know it was a Bowie song. I imagine she'd have written Bowie off as a weirdo. Always with the priorities, that one. You know where I'm going now, don't you? You should. It's incredibly obvious. I don't want to have to be holding your hand as you read this. Fucking inspired, if I do say so. Not that the idea wasn't handed to me on a plate. God sent me a boat and all that. About 10 people a year die from food-induced anaphylaxis. Even with all the money and privilege, why wouldn't she be one of them? And it's hard to pin a deadly peach intolerance on an unseen enemy. But why shouldn't this one be easy? Some of these kills took proper planning. Let's not forget the weeks of frog drudgery and the deep dive into London sex party scene. I spent months figuring out just how much I could manipulate a kid on the internet so I could get to Janine. Hard when you have a full-time job, an increasingly obsessive long-distance running habit. Lady Macbeth sleepwalks, trying to scrub imaginary blood from her hands. I run for miles in any direction away from my crimes. Yeah, it doesn't take a therapist, thank you. And a dispensation towards anxiety that isn't so much a character flaw, but doesn't help when you're juggling responsibilities. I never knew quite how close Bryony was to her parents. For all that I studied the family and befriended their staff, they were set apart, living in a world I would never gain access to, no matter how high I climbed or how much I stalked. What I knew for sure, that she was an only child, that she still lived at home, that she never mentioned her parents on social media, was mixed in with other tidbits. Her mother had spent most of her time in Monaco. Nobody does this unless they're very keen on avoiding tax. Living there for at least 8 months of the year for 5 full years. Simon would fly in and out but seemed to be based here full-time. Bryony, like all the other girls in her world, frequented Saint-Tropez but didn't show up chez Maman very often. The last official visit, official as in she posted it on Instagram, was 2 years before Janine had her unfortunate accident. Even after Janine died, there was no direct mention of her on Bryony's social media. She took a 3-week break from posting and then came back with an image of her silhouette against a disappearing sun, complete with a heart emoji, and was posting sponsored content 2 days later. Janine was buried in England, and the house she owned in Monaco had sat empty ever since. I don't imagine that was for any sentimental reasons, but because the house was where the business was registered. Then there was just total supposition based on all of this information. I suspected that Simon and Janine had lived completely separate lives, probably for a long time. This wasn't just because of the Monaco situation, though obviously bolstered the theory. Who spends most of the year away from their partner if they don't need to? The gossip had long been that Janine had grown tired of Simon's constant infidelities and finally taken action to protect herself and her stake in the business. The rumour, backed up by Tina, who reiterated it in an excited whisper one day when I met her for a drink after work, was that the kicker came when Simon was discovered to have kept another yacht for his mistress and had been using a speedboat to ferry him between the two when the family were on holiday. Threatening to divorce him and take half of his money, Janine played a blinder and somehow managed, with the help of a truckload of accountants who she must have been paying handsomely, to persuade Simon that there was another option. No divorce or loss of assets, but he had to sign the business over to her. Simon must have done the maths, realised that this deal kept him Janine's prisoner and still signed the papers. Better to be a rich prisoner than suffer the indignity of the tabloids raking over your private life and having to hand over a hefty chunk of cash to boot. There was an upside. Janine living in Monaco meant that he would no longer pay tax. Rich people see tax the way some people see climate change. It's a social justice issue worth taking to the streets for. The very rich mainly live under the impression that they earned their money. They have no time for any theoretical argument about whether it's truly possible for anyone to deserve such an individual accumulation of wealth. Once they have it, they turn golem-like, ferocious in their protection of their goods and wealth. So Janine had lived a nice life in Monaco, where lunches took weeks of planning and there was much complaining to be done about the responsibilities of staff, and Simon was free to do whatever he wanted back in London. Bryony wasn't involved in the equation at all, really. She was their daughter, in that she had the family name and provided the bridge between her parents, but it didn't seem like she was playing Monopoly round the fire at Christmas with them. It didn't feel like the kind of family you would recognise, either functional or dysfunctional. Instead, their unit felt like one which had all the bearings of something enviable, with none of the emotions which would actually make it so. Maybe I was wrong. The problem with doing all of this from a distance was that I could never really know these people and their innermost thoughts. Then again, I thought I understood Jimmy inside and out, and he'd surprised me. His betrayal made him 5% more interesting, at least. Maybe Janine and Simon really did love Bryony in a very deep and real sense. I could only go on what I glimpsed. Not that it mattered. I wasn't trying to absolve myself or hope that it wouldn't hurt Simon to lose his daughter. I'd have killed him first if I wanted to spare him that pain. No, obviously the sequence in which I murdered his loved ones was crucial. That's why he came last. He had to experience it all. The reveal would be the thing that broke him. I knew it was a long shot. I couldn't rely on such a sloppy approach. And yet something in me couldn't shut it down without even trying it out, albeit from a slightly different tack. I wouldn't waste any time on it. It was a one-time attempt and it had to be done fast, without too much thought. I took myself off at lunchtime to buy 6 luxury beauty products in cash from a few different department stores. I bought a range of face creams, one with peach seed extract. When I got back to the office, I locked myself in the disabled toilet, spread them out on the floor and got to work. The most expensive bottle contained a face mask made from pearls. Is there anything now that brands won't add to a beauty product to make it more desirable? At some point, a clever marketing manager will suggest using antimatter in a night serum, and the rich women of London, Moscow and New York will lap it up. And I hazarded a guess that Bryony would, if she bothered to even open the box, have an eye for the most high-end product. This was the bottle I was staking it all on. It was a tree to be hidden in a forest, hence the other products ready to be packed beside it in a fancy box. All nice stuff, but she'd have tried most of it already. And there's nothing as alluring to a vain Instagrammer as a new product promising a level of luminosity not previously seen before. The face mask and the cream which contained the peach seed extract were made by the same company. That was important for any future investigation. The other products were a mishmash of brands. I decanted 4 drops of the cream into the face mask bottle using a pipette I'd bought at a veterinary surgery a few weeks back. For my poor dog's eye condition. Animal lovers are always mad to talk about ailments, and I had to work hard on my feet to explain the fictitious dog's weepy eye to the weedy-looking nurse who seemed to find this condition completely fascinating, and shook the bottle vigorously. Opening it again, I sniffed the liquid. If it smelt like peach, I'd be in trouble. It pretty much smelt like any generic face lotion. Sweet, but not identifiably fruity. I needed a little more reassurance, though, and added 1 drop of the almond essence you add to cakes to be certain. That stuff overpowers anything else in a recipe. 1 more shake and I sniffed it again. Success. The liquid now reminded me of a bakery, warm and reassuring, which, given my intent, felt pleasingly inappropriate. I carefully cleaned the bottle with a baby wipe and threw the peach extract cream in the bin. The products then went into a plain white cardboard box lined with tissue paper. A card attached simply read, "Bryony, we hope you enjoy these goodies. The pearl face mask is a dream. Kiss, kiss." I desperately wanted to say it was to die for, but I couldn't allow myself to be quite so on the nose. All wrapped up, I stashed the box in a bag under my desk and tried to forget about it as the working day dragged on. I wasn't normally someone to leave on the dot of 5:30 p.m. People who do that are usually the dullest and most aggravating colleagues. the kind that go on and on in inconsequential meetings and insist on a proper system for communal fridge but refuse to engage in meaningful work. They are also the least fireable employees, since they have normally read their contract requirements thoroughly and know exactly what they can get away with. And not that it matters, but this particular kind of colleague is never the attractive, charismatic one. They're not leaving in order to go and get change for an exciting party. But bang on 5:30 p.m, I packed up my stuff and headed out, vaguely mentioning a doctor's appointment in case anyone raised an eyebrow. Nobody did. People swanned in and out for appointments all the time, and it wasn't uncommon for some members of staff to take pamper hours where they'd duck out of the office for teeth whitening session or an eyebrow tint. It's great for customer interface, my boss would say, which meant nothing but let her go and get Botox on company time. I managed to get to the parcel shop 5 minutes before closing. I sent it recorded delivery, assuming the Artemis housekeeper would sign for it, and gave no sender details. She wouldn't look for them. People like Bryony receive 100 gift boxes a week. As I stepped out into the fading autumn light, the shop bell tinkled and the door slammed shut. I took it as a sign. I would not check Bryony's social media accounts in the hope that she'd succumbed. I'd given it a shot, and it was out of my hands now. I spent the next month busy at work. Sales season was approaching, and I was organising the social media campaigns and making sure that discount emails were sent out to customers who'd signed up to receive them. I knew from research that 95% of these went unread, dropped in spam boxes the moment they landed. It was a pointless exercise, but data was invaluable, we were told. The tone of the messages we sent out was enough to make even the most ardent shopper a card-carrying anti-consumerist. The word "fry-yay" was used in one email before I shut it down. When I wasn't trying to preserve the English language and my own dignity in the office, I was looking for new ways to kill Bryony. As with all the previous deaths, it felt important that this one should take place while Bryony was doing something normal for her. It lent more credibility to the accident scenario and required less elaborate planning. I want these killings done. Done well, yes, but I'm not an enthusiastic fan of homicide, researching the most fascinating and gruesome ways to kill. There's a certain art to a good murder. I will admit to being impressed by the lengths that some people will go to, but I don't want to get caught up in more and more extreme plans which eventually result in me hanging off a zip line through central London, decapitating someone with a samurai sword just for theatrics. After a lot of false starts, I come across a potential opportunity. There is a man, some of you might know him, who has become a mainstay in the well-being industry. His name is Russell Chan, and he has made millions off a nutritional program called Manifest and Maintain. If you've not heard of this nonsense, then you could spend 1,000 years trying to guess what his company does from the name alone, so I'll break it down. His brand, or innovation, as he called it in his TED talk, which I watched 3 minutes of before deciding that death was preferable, consists of two main elements. The first is making you copy down positive affirmations that you stick around the house on special pastel-coloured post-it notes that he sends you once you've signed up. The second is telling you to exercise for 85 minutes a day and giving you juicing recipes every morning. The creativity that goes into coming up with different blends of fruits and vegetables 365 days a year, you absolutely do not get Christmas Day off, is stunning. And by stunning, I mean a waste of some poor nutritionist's degree. The post-it notes conceal the fact that this is a diet plan. The MM app is £8.99 to download and costs a further £4 a month for the rest of your life. People have tried to cancel their subscriptions, but I've never met anyone who's managed it. Most people don't, because idiots love Russell Chan. They seem incredulous when they lose weight, as though it was a secret science they've discovered and not a meal replacement offering which cuts out all calorific options. They bang on about the confidence they've got from, I assume, computer-generated inspirational quotes that they stick around their bookless homes, where they presumably fight for space between the reclaimed wood sign that says love and the rose gold plant baskets. I admire Chan. He's a terrible monster, but he's only rinsing the willing. He got out of finance before the huge crash a few years ago, and he tapped straight into the wellness market, using that banker's brain to speculate on what the masses would want in a time of financial insecurity, and he made millions from it, correctly guessing that the herd would want to treat themselves in small but comforting ways, find peace of mind in platitudes, and crucially, look better. You can't get a mortgage anymore, but you can wear shiny leggings with that newfound confidence. So the MM ideology is available to the masses, but it relies on looking exclusive. Chan knew from the beginning that the scheme would only work if the beautiful people repped it for him. Every year around May, he invites 100 of the most influential movers and shakers to come to his private retreat in Ibiza, where he hosts a weekend of exercise classes, juice workshops, and positivity seminars. Every year, without fail, the Daily Mail and another celeb-sniffing publication breathlessly scour the Instagram accounts of said movers, grabbing screenshots of the beautiful people doing sun salutations by an infinity pool, hugging each other in a tangled mass of undernourished bronze limbs, and generally gushing about how much they've learnt about their soul from the three-day trip. There is a party on the last night where, according to a girl I know who works in beauty PR, copious amounts of alcohol and drugs get mixed into the fruit smoothies. Everyone gets completely off their faces and all phones are banned. I suppose this last night blowout acts as an apology for all the dull hikes they've been forced to do over the previous 2 days. Guess who was going on the next retreat? I found out about Bryony's plans because my boring mum Instagram account follows nearly everyone that she does and I keep tabs. Months ahead and Chan was already busy teasing his 8 million followers with pictures of the planned Ibiza weekend, using the dubious hashtag clean hedonism below photos of yoga mats neatly aligned on the sun deck and video clips of white linen-clad staff mowing lawns. Below an image of neon balloons tied to a tree, Bryony had posted a comment. Can't wait to join my soul tribe. I got busy. The weekend itself would be off-limits, but the party sounded like something I could work with. I looked around to find out who organised the last night party. Not an impossible task, since everyone tags everyone on social media as a way of getting discounts for genuine work. Sure enough, the event was run by a company based in Watford called Bespoke Bangers. Such genuine Balearic vibes. I'd waitstaffed many events in my early 20s and felt confident that I'd be in with a shot at serving a bunch of coked-up models. There was an application form on their website and I filled it out, emphasising the many exclusive, unimagined parties I'd worked at. I stressed that I'd be working in Ibiza around the dates of the party and explained that I'd heard that they had clients on the island and I was looking for extra shifts. Someone called Sasha emailed back within 24 hours asking for a video chat, which I assumed was to make sure that I looked attractive enough for the gig. It was fine by me. A fake name covered me, and I wouldn't be stupid enough to send over a photo which could be easily retrieved. I slapped on makeup for the chat, darkening my brows and applying red lipstick, two things which changed the face subtly, but effectively. Sasha called 90 minutes later than suggested, which meant I had to hop off a bus and dash into a coffee shop to take the call. She was brusque and decisive, asking me to do some London shifts over the next week to ensure that I was going to be a good match for the company. The whole call took less than 5 minutes. I'd been right about appearance being the main purpose of it. We agreed that I'd work at an event at the Shard the following Tuesday. Details were vague, but it was an event for a well-known YouTuber who was launching a self-tanning product. I was to get there at 5 p.m. and wear black trousers. A shirt would be provided. Don't look at the guests unless you're offering them a top-up. Nobody wants a creepy waitress getting starry-eyed, Sasha said as she typed over her keyboard, taking her own advice about eye contact. The event went smoothly. I had to rush from work, another day knocking off early, but what else could I do? The room was bathed in peachy light, with flower arrangements dotted about the space and goodie bags stacked under tables weighed down with biscuits iced with the brand logo. It was far from packed, but everyone was eagerly taking selfies with the host, who seemed pleased with the guests busy live-streaming the wall of balloons. I poured champagne and kept my head suitably bowed. Not that I recognised a single one of these people. The Warhol prediction about the future of fame has been completely gazumped by the rise of online personalities. 15 minutes seems oddly quaint when you see these empty-headed kids desperately trying to make a video go viral every single day. The feedback obviously satisfied Sasha, and I was booked for 3 more London events. They were cash in hand, which was a relief, and usually over within 2 hours. The youth of London don't larger up much, preferring to get home and apply a sheet mask while watching the latest Netflix drop. A month later, I got a text from Sasha telling me that she had 3 events lined up in Ibiza that I could work. She enclosed the dates and one of them landed on the last night of the wellness retreat. There was no further information. But I felt pretty confident that there wouldn't be 2 parties happening on the same night, both covered by Bespoke Bangers. I replied immediately, confirming my availability, and booked flights and accommodation for my Ibiza stay that night. I wasn't going to veer too far from the original germ of an idea. Bryony liked her booze, and a party as hedonistic as the MM one would likely get messy fairly quickly. Nothing like a 3-day juice fast to get you drunk after one cocktail. A few drops of peach puree in a glass and she'd be done on the dance floor within minutes. A bunch of health obsessives surrounding her, and yet I'd bet my life on none of them having any proper medical training to help her. I had 6 weeks to wait. Except I didn't in the end, because Bryony died later that very night. I didn't even know about it until the next evening. For all we're bombarded with news all day long, it's remarkably easy to opt out of it all if you do something as basic as to forget to charge your phone. I was out of the office that Wednesday on a training day designed to empower women in business. It was mandatory, which suggested that it was more to do with ameliorating the recent sexual harassment allegations against a team leader than it was about promoting women in the business. After 8 hours spent in workshops where 14 of us sat around in a circle and role-played challenging office scenarios with each other, I ducked out of the coffee and cake option at the end and speed-walked for the tube. My phone was dead, so I spent the journey watching a young couple having a fight about whether their success in keeping a houseplant alive meant they were ready to get a dog yet. She rolled her eyes a lot. He looked away even more. I worried for this imaginary dog. I even felt a pang for the houseplant. As I exited the tube station, I grabbed an Evening Standard and rolled it up, stashing it in my bag. 20 minutes later, I was home, and I set about unpacking the food I'd grabbed from the local health food store and turning on the heating. It was only then that I took the paper and sat down at my kitchen table. The main story was something typically dull about a council house shortage, which I skimmed over because everyone knows that the Standard only led with that stuff so the rest of the paper can be filled with coverage of a new 10-quid ice cream shop in Kensington, or a puff piece on a fitness class where you use gold weights. To the side was a small photo of a girl. A selfie taken from an angle. 75% mouth. The familiar whoosh of adrenaline began snaking through my veins. Adrenaline punches your energy levels up to 100 while also freezing time. Everything slows down, becomes woolly, reactions get blunted. I knew instinctively who I was looking at, but the fog which had enveloped my brain prevented me from fully registering what was happening for a split second. Heiress dead at 27. I opened the paper, and there, on page 3, was another photo of her, this time much younger, standing between her parents at an event. Bryony. The details were scant. She'd been found unconscious in her bedroom at 7:30 p.m. by a member of staff, Reed Maid. Paramedics were called, but she was pronounced dead at the scene. The article mentioned the tragic death of her mother just months before, intimating that suicide must be a possibility. I knew that was nonsense. Bryony wouldn't have killed herself in a fug of grief. She didn't dive down to those emotional levels. Everything was boredom, mockery, or desire for her. Base-level stuff. The family spokesman had pleaded for privacy at this difficult time, and apart from the basic stuff about Simon and her gilded life, no more information was given. I spent a frenzied hour checking Instagram, news sites, and gossip blogs. Her last post was at 4 p.m, a photo of her on a rug looking at a sausage dog. Hopefully this one was just on loan, hashtag where is Fendi, which sat beside her. The caption read, "When Bay wants love." So no helpful pointers for the press which would help them with their tragic rich girl narrative. Elsewhere, a few Instagram friends professed their shock with prayer hand emojis and crying faces. RIP was floated around a lot, an expression I've always hated. Rest in peace. No matter how lively or funny or desperate to live you were, just rest now. A generic, pointless comment. But there were no new details, nothing to grasp at. Where was Simon? Was he at home when it happened, or was he out with some new fling, dining at a private members bar making a business deal? How did he find out? Did the maid call him, or did the police? Was he alone now? Without his wife, without his daughter, his only recognised child, his parents gone, his brother dead? Did he have an inkling of what was happening yet? How could he? He'd managed away my existence, just as he'd managed away every other troublesome detail in his privileged life. But I was alone too. With every other death, I had made it happen. Been there for the last breath. Felt like I was in control. Here, I was just like everyone else who had picked up a paper. I knew nothing and could tell nobody. For the first time in a long while, I wanted my mum. I wanted her to know that her daughter was the one who was alive, that I was doing this for her, that I would never let her life have been discarded and forgotten by these people. But I wasn't going to be one of those people who thought they could sense their dead loved one smiling down on them, and I wouldn't be pulled into a maudlin pity party for myself. I opened a bottle of wine and ran myself a bath. Bryony was dead. The details could wait. Her demise meant so much more than ticking another one off my list. It meant that the list was almost complete. One more to go. Daddy dearest, I was coming for you. Chapter 14. Writing that all down made me laugh. What a hammy cliffhanger to end on. But I'd finished the story of Bryony's demise at 2 a.m. in total silence and darkness. Even Kelly wasn't snoring. I was wired by the end of it, remembering the moment when I realised that I only had one target left. I'd been so close and it had felt so monumental. From the confines of this cell, I wish I'd enjoyed those moments a little more. I should have gone dancing after every murder, or bought myself precious jewellery for every target I'd crossed off the list. I had a list. Did I mention that? A physical list, I mean. It was written down in pencil on the back of a photo of me and my mother. The Latimers had given it to me one Christmas shortly after I'd moved into their house. It wasn't a huge surprise, given that it was my photo, but Sophie had found it in my desk drawer and taken it to the framers to be displayed properly. "You must see this every day, my darling," she said when I opened it. "Your mother loved you so very much." I knew this, of course, and I didn't need Sophie to tell me how much. Besides, I'm not sure Sophie had spoken to my mother, really, beyond brief arrangements about playdates, which always took place at the Latimer house. So much easier for the kids with all this space, she'd tell Marie. So her insistence at constantly reminding me that I had been so loved used to get slightly irritating. Jimmy used to roll his eyes when Sophie would trill about how proud Marie would be of my exam results or my excellent fairy cakes. Thank fuck for Jimmy. But it was a nice frame, and I'd hung it by my bed at the Latimers. When I moved out, it was always displayed somewhere I could see it when I woke up. When I was planning how to kill Kathleen and Jeremy, I'd taken it off the wall and held it, looking at Marie's face a while, wondering what she'd make of my intentions. Probably she'd have been horrified and anguished, devastated that I'd decided to waste my life trying to avenge her own. But she wasn't here to tell me that, so I didn't have to give her opinion much weight. And besides, I was doing this for myself as well. Marie was dead and gone. In life, she'd never wanted to right those wrongs done to her. But she'd never wanted to right the wrongs done to me either. We both suffered because she was too weak to demand what was fair. I'd ended up as an extra in a family that wasn't my own, with no security or safety net. With the shot of losing my mother and the chaser of seeing my father parade his legitimate family all around town, if I wanted to redress the balance, she could hardly protest. Before I'd put the photo back on the wall, I'd taken the pencil I was making notes in and scrawled the names of every Artemis I figured I'd have to kill on the back of the frame. The marks were light enough that you'd barely notice them unless you were really looking. But every time I'd drawn a line through a name, I'd held the pencil down, dragging it through every letter until they were completely obliterated. It was a small but important marker. But I could have bought some nice jewellery too. After I'd finished recounting the tale of Bryony and her sad encounter with some peach serum, I'd fallen asleep, waking in a panic when the morning bell sounded. I was still holding my notepad, and Kelly was moving about the cell, singing a hideous rendition of a One Direction song. I assumed the original was dire enough, but her pitch made it endlessly worse. I pushed the paper between the mattress and the bed frame and said good morning. Stupid, careless mistake to risk Kelly seeing my work. I watched as she brushed her teeth and applied foundation that was slightly too dark for her skin. I was surprised to see how many women made an effort to look nice while locked up when I first got here, but now I understand it better. Prison will try and dominate every part of you if you're not careful. From prosaic things like how many pairs of socks you can have to more intimate ones, like changing the things you dream about. Before I came here, I had vivid and surreal dreams almost every night. Now I dream about just one thing. Running down the river path, wind behind me and sky all around. Don't need Freud to analyse that. So a bit of makeup helps ground you a little bit, I understand. But blend it better, Kelly. That's all it would take. I felt fairly confident that she'd not seen the notepad. Her demeanour was as blandly cheerful as ever, and she wittered on about a visitor she had coming later that day. "A friend," she said as she applied coat after coat of spidery mascara. "But maybe he wants more, couldn't blame him." Kelly looked at me in the mirror and I could see that the girl was desperate for me to ask her more about this visitor. But I wasn't in the mood to listen to a slightly delusional monologue about how desirable Kelly was to the opposite sex. And so I pulled on my tracksuit, told her I hoped it went well, and headed off to the library. I should finish off explaining what happened with Caro, since it's why I'm in here, wearing a polyester tracksuit instead of something nice from Max Mara. It's why Kelly is the closest person to me, since Jimmy won't reply to my letters and I've realised I have very few other friends. I knew that before, really. I didn't exactly spend my time cultivating close relationships before all of this. I was possessed, I see that now. Only focusing on my plan to cut down the Artemis family and not even having the foresight to build up a life that would be waiting for me once it was all done. Stupid, of course. I relied on Jimmy to be there when I was finished, thinking that he'd be enough and that the rest would come easily. And most people are sort of terrible. Thick or dull or a hideous combination of both. I could never tolerate it, and so I never tried to. My current predicament has hardly disabused me of this notion. But Jimmy wasn't the constant in my life that I presumed he would be. 2 days after Gemma Adebayo had told me that I was free to go, I had been woken up early by a hammering at my front door. I opened it blearily and was promptly arrested for the murder of Caro Morton. I was taken back to the police station, this time with less concern for my comfort or well-being, and charged. As I sat with the detectives for several hours that day, it all began to come out. Jimmy had told the police he thought it was a murder immediately, yelling about how much I hated Caro. My jealousy, it was suggested, led me to push her violently off the balcony in hope that it would look like a tragic accident. The other girl left at the party gave a signed statement saying that I'd argued with Jimmy about his engagement and then asked Caro to come and smoke with me outside. This mousy girl, who I later found out was called Angelica and who was decidedly less weedy than her appearance had suggested, was instrumental in the case against me. Who knew that the girl with a fulsome collection of Alice bands had it in her? I was refused bail after it was passionately argued that I was a risk to the public, which made me screw my face up in disbelief and swear loudly, something the judge didn't appreciate much. My appointed brief, a flailing graduate who hadn't even read my notes before he entered the courtroom, did nothing to push back on this and was fired the moment I exited the building and was remanded into custody. It was then that I got my first taste of jail. It was a horrible shock initially. The centre I was sent to was a grim concrete block behind a huge wall in South London. I was strip-searched, relieved of my possessions and sent to a holding cell. It was freezing cold and I spent 3 days obsessing over what, if anything, I had left in my flat, which might point the police towards my actual crimes. I visualised every corner of my home, mentally walking around the flat to try and remember anything I might have been sloppy enough to leave on display. I couldn't sleep, and my mind kept distorting the images I tried to conjure, making me start again and again until I wept with frustration. By day three, I felt calmer, having forced myself to breathe deeply for an hour. By then, I was confident that nothing would point towards the Artemis deaths. This was bolstered by the knowledge that the police weren't looking for anything that wasn't connected to Caro, and nobody knew of my connection to the murders anyway. As far as they were concerned, I'd spontaneously pushed a love rival off a balcony in a fit of jealousy. Unless they were hoping that I was the kind of person who kept a deeply confessional diary, any evidence for that would be sparse. How ridiculous that I only decided to start a deeply confessional diary once I was actually in the bowels of the criminal justice system. I hired a new lawyer, Victoria Herbert, and prayed that she would be the Rottweiler she promised to be, a Rottweiler in Hermes scarves and Louboutin heels, the way I liked it. Herbert was bullish about my chances at getting off. There was no forensic evidence, apart from some contact Caro and I had during the course of the night, and the bulk of the case was based on testimony from Angelica Saunders and Jimmy. Jimmy giving evidence against me. Jimmy, the only person I truly cared about, telling the court that he believed I had pushed his fiancée off a balcony, not looking at me once during the trial. Jimmy, pictured in the sun one Friday, walking hand in hand into court with Angelica, her in a hideous tweed pencil skirt and ballet shoes looking proud. Jimmy might have left me in a bemused heap, but I began to respect Angelica's hustle. The jury deliberated for 6 hours. Victoria sat with me during that wait, which felt like a year. When we were told that the jury was ready to return a verdict, she was ebullient, assuring me that a quick turnaround was definitely a good sign. For all her bluster, she was completely wrong on that count. Guilty, guilty, guilty. The word echoed around the courtroom as people gasped and one man shouted something angrily from the gallery. I stood there, my hand reaching for my throat, trying to remember to breathe and failing. I looked towards Jimmy, who was sitting with his head on Sophie's shoulder as John patted his arm mechanically. Only Jimmy's sister, Annabelle, looked at me, tilting her head as though she was sizing me up for the first time. And that was that. I was sentenced to 16 years and taken to Limehouse a week later. I missed the window for an appeal, stuck in shock and unable to know what to do next. But then George Thorpe came along, a middle-aged white man here to save the day as he imagined he was born to do. He had an appeal granted, arguing that there was further eyewitness testimony which was not sought out by the police at that time. I appointed Thorpe at considerable cost after I got here, realising that Victoria Herbert was much more interested in promoting herself as a glamorous attack dog than actually being one. She appeared in Grazia, off the back of my case, barely pretending to bat away praise and using the word empowered far too much. The staggering fee my new brief charged was made possible because he offered to do it on a buy-now, pay-later basis. I could see his rationale for this. He wanted some publicity and I could give it to him in spades. I imagine he was aiming for QC and felt like a high-interest murder case might bolster his chances. He was quite the showman. At the many high-profile trials he'd worked on, the media slavishly reported on his arguments, his floral language, his habit of thumping the table when he was in mid-passionate defence of his clients. Thorpe had a stellar success rate, which meant I felt relaxed about his final bill. Whatever happened, I'd have enough money to put him on a permanent retainer once I'd laid claim to the Artemis Empire. Credit to Thorpe. He exposed every possible flaw in the trial, and he used the press to highlight those flaws, knowing that they'd run any story they could on the Morton murderer. During the trial, they painted me as a bitter and damaged girl in love with her stepbrother. He wasn't, of course, but the tabloids love some incest light. But once I'd been sentenced, a new angle was needed. Now I was damaged, but no longer bitter. My fragility was played up. She had nobody, really, except for Jimmy. And images of me were printed where I looked shy and vulnerable, rather than hard and arrogant. These photos were provided by old workmates, judging by the clothes I was wearing, and I'm only in them because they were mandatory. It's amazing what you can decide somebody is like simply from a photo. Thorpe had an old school friend who worked in PR seed some stories about Caro's mental health problems, and hints were dropped about her eating disorder, her love of a good party, read drugs, and her temper. Awful tactics, really, but this isn't a discussion about media ethics, and besides, I would have taken 100 stories ripping Caro to shreds if it had helped my case. I'd have read them even if they hadn't helped my case. I have been festering in Limehouse for 14 months now, and waiting on the appeal for nearly half that time. When I first appointed him, I would call George Thorpe daily and write long letters to him, urging him to explore the balcony again or to force Caro's therapist to testify to her mental state. I was desperate to be out in days, not weeks, and I was furious every time the lawyer told me to be patient. When it became clear that I would be here for a while, I fell into a depression of sorts. I'm not somebody who gets depressed. I sometimes feel a rising panic in my throat and a need to escape, but I'd never understood people who get so sad that they retreat from life. Perhaps prison makes us all more empathetic. Or maybe it's just natural to get depressed in a place which has strip lighting and communal showers. I started to sleep more, and for a time it felt as though my brain was swimming in treacle. My thoughts slowed down. I stopped exercising, and on one particularly low day, I watched the Emmerdale omnibus all the way through with Kelly telling me who everyone was, constantly without wanting to slam her head against the wall once. One day, 8 months in, I woke up and did 500 press-ups. I was fed up of this alien mood and scared that I would languish in it forever if I didn't force myself to climb out of it. So I started a strict regimen, waking up at the same time every day, pushing my body harder and harder with exercises in my cell and walks around the yard. I spent hours in the library reading anything that would give my head a break from this place and pestered my lawyer again, but this time with more focus. And now I am near the appeal decision and writing this all down to take my mind off it. I am confident that I will be freed and have already written my speech to read out on the court steps. I think I've struck the right tone, injured but magnanimous, and I will wear just enough makeup to look attractive, but not so much that I look like I've spent 14 months having a nice time. I want you to be able to see the dark rings under my eyes and immediately know that I have been nearly broken, but not quite, by my ordeal. I will talk about how we must remember that despite the trauma of being incarcerated, there is another victim in all of this. Caro, I will say, looking straight at the cameras. I lost nearly 2 years of my life to this injustice, but Caro lost her whole life that night, and we must never forget that. Perhaps I'll end neatly by announcing that I will be establishing a mentoring scheme for female prisoners with eating disorders in her name, in the hope that I can help even one vulnerable woman. She'd fucking hate being called vulnerable. I don't think my confidence in being released is misplaced, by the way. The police, with the help from the devious Angelica, really did just decide that it had been a murder and did little to test their supposition. I cannot claim to be the perfect innocent in all areas of my life, but in this I truly am the victim of a huge miscarriage of justice. What a tightrope to walk. George Thorpe saw immediately how badly the case had been handled and has exposed flaws in practically every part of the process. This might all be enough, and it was all certainly enough to ensure an appeal was granted, but it was no silver bullet. That came only a couple of weeks ago. But it's enough to almost guarantee my conviction is quashed. Thorpe had come to see me for a long-arranged update, and I wasn't expecting any major news. But I could tell the moment he walked in that something big had happened. His neck was red, and it was rising up towards his face as he strode towards me purposefully in the visiting room, brushing impatiently past other people, his long wool coat flying behind him. It was, he said, the result of 2 months' relentless digging by his team. The night Miss Smorton had her unfortunate tumble, the police made inquiries at every other flat in the mansion block. He pulled out a list of other properties in the building. There are 5 flats on each floor, arranged almost like a pentagon, but only 3 face the gardens while the other 2 face the road. Miss Morton's apartment was the middle of the 3 garden-facing properties. Her neighbours to the right are a couple in their mid-60s who have been in the block for 30 years, long before the high-income professionals started buying in Clapham, and they were at home the night of the incident. Thorpe never used the word death when a more polite description could be found. They were very used to Miss Morton's parties and showed a remarkable lack of sympathy about her tragic accident, perhaps as a result. They were very clear about not seeing or hearing a thing because they retired to bed at 10 p.m. armed with earplugs. Thorpe raised his eyebrows here, but I could well understand how annoying it must have been living next door to that entitled girl. The police attempted to make inquiries at the flat on the left of Mrs. Morton's flat, number 22, but there was no answer that morning or later that day. They did further investigate the flat and its owners, but were told by the building's management company that the owners lived abroad and were never in the country, so the police left it there. He used his gold fountain pen to stab at the paper in front of him. That was a huge oversight, but sadly typical of our police force. The reason we didn't look into this earlier is because the write-up suggested that contact had been made with the owners of number 22 and assurances had been given that they were out of the country. We had no reason to doubt that your previous brief had investigated this thoroughly, but a clever chap in my office went through the reports from the evening in question and found that she hadn't looked any further into the next-door flat. I thought again about Victoria Herbert's vertiginous high heels and fervently hoped that she would fall down an escalator in them. Perhaps I would help make that happen when I got out of this place. Thorpe looked at me quizzically and I snapped back to attention. This is where it got interesting. This fellow, one of my team, as I say, did a bit of digging and found out that the flat is registered to a company based in the Cayman Islands. Do you know what an offshore company is, Grace? I rolled my eyes and followed the action up quickly with a sweet smile as I assured him that I did in fact know what that was, patronising fool. Well, under current UK law, foreign entities can buy property here without revealing who they are. It's scandalous, of course, and a system which allows for all sorts of dodgy dealings. Mainly money laundering, of course. The government is planning to force these anonymous owners to reveal themselves, but it's tricky and likely to take a while. I cut him off. Right. Well, I think I've heard enough about land laws. What did he find, this man of yours? He cleared his throat and looked suitably chastened, but that might just be the default expression of posh men, so it was hard to tell. Well, it's been hard work, as I say, a tangled web. David, that's my associate's name, he spent 2 months on this, trying to make contact with the company, but a phone number in the Cayman Islands, which doesn't work, isn't much to go on. Often these companies don't even have a real office out there, just hiring a room so they have an address. Eventually, he hired an investigator who deals with this sort of thing to dig out who owns the company and where they are. I was getting impatient now, and visiting hour was whizzing by. With respect, George, I hired you to deal with all of this and it sounds like you're doing a marvellous job, but sometimes you don't need to know how the sausage was made and I've got spa treatments lined up back to back this afternoon, you understand? Right, yes, sorry. Well. David finally, after a lot of misdirection and fobbing off, found the owners of the flat. They live in Moscow and are none too keen on replying to emails. So he went out there last week and made contact with them on Thursday. He explained your plight and asked if there was any way they could help. A housekeeper who might have been in the flat, for example, or a CCTV camera. It was a long shot, of course, but it was worth trying. And what do you know? Thorpe was looking as jolly as a schoolboy now. They told David that they had CCTV cameras up the wazoo, said it was standard at all their properties. David could hardly keep up the prentice of calm professionalism when they said they had one on their balcony, concealed by a small bush. And did they keep the tapes? Asked David. Why, yes, said the Russians. They kept everything on a database, of course. It was best, though they didn't elaborate on exactly why it was best. He stopped for breath as I held mine. David has a copy, Grace. He's watched them and they will be in the office as soon as the footage has been verified by an expert. It doesn't show the entire balcony, but it shows enough. You're not in scene when Caro takes her final bow. I nearly fell to the floor in relief. A feeling like the sun warming your body on the first day of summer enveloped my body, and I grabbed Thorpe's hand without thinking about what I was doing. Thank you. Thank you. I don't know what I can say, but thank you. And David, and the Russians, thank you. He looked pleased, the blush rushing up his face once more. Well, we've done our job, and it's all very good news. I can't get you out today, sadly, but you've only got a few more weeks in here, and there can be no doubt that this footage will exonerate you completely. A bell buzzed, and he looked at his watch and gathered up his papers. I'll be in touch the moment we have news. In the meantime, hold tight, and keep all this quiet until it's official. I thanked him again and shook his hand. As he turned to go, George Thorpe looked around at me and said, with some embarrassment, "Do they really have a spa in here?" And that, as they say, was that. I walked back to my cell, fists clenched in excitement, barely able to focus on where I was going or what I was doing. Kelly was sitting on the lower bunk, using a piece of string to thread her eyebrows and singing Beyoncé songs in a key I'm not sure the lady herself has ever been acquainted with. "You look white as a ghost, mate," she said as she looked up at me. "Bad news from the brief?" I told her what Thorpe had revealed. I was too excited not to. All my usual front was gone. Stupid to tell Kelly anything, really, but what harm could it do now? She was genuinely sweet about it, grabbing my hand and offering to hook me up with a friend of hers in the Angel who rented rooms with no need for references. I'd managed to keep my flat on while I'd been at this place. It was a stretch, but it was important for me to know that there was something waiting for me when I got out. Even though I knew it wouldn't be my home for much longer, once the money came through, I'd be looking to upgrade as fast as possible. And even if I wasn't, there was no way I'd be renting a room off some dodgy mate of Kelly's. Nothing in life was that desperate. She pulled out her secret phone and started typing, presumably looking to alert her slum landlord friend to a possible new tenant before I talked her down. I hope the offer didn't mean she thought we'd be continuing our relationship in the outside world. Kelly was a limpet I found it hard enough to detach in here. If she had the freedom to travel and the use of a mobile, I'd be completely at her mercy. Visions of her turning up at my house with face masks and a cheap bottle of wine loomed ominously in my mind. Not quite the new life I had envisaged. Oh, I should go back a little bit. Time is strange in jail. It goes so slowly that I really thought I would go mad at the beginning. And then the appeal gained traction and suddenly I'm whizzing over things in my haste to finish this story off and start living a new life, not one dominated by nasty but necessary things like murder. The moment my conviction was quashed, Jimmy got in touch. Well, actually, the CPS had been in touch with him a week before the final decision to inform him of the new evidence. He'd written a letter for Thorpe to give to me almost immediately. I won't relay the entire thing, going on as it did for 3 full pages. Jimmy is not a natural writer. His continued, and I think willful, misuse of grammar has always made it hard for me to read his emails and texts. I guess The Guardian is more relaxed about grammatical errors than some publications. A deluge of small mistakes littered a letter that otherwise might have been quite moving. As it was, I winced at every line. Suffice to say, he was full of remorse. He had let me down in the most monumental of ways, which was true, and he had barely slept since I was convicted. Which I knew was bollocks. The man has a special gift for falling asleep in the most trying of times, but I appreciated the sentiment. After endless apologies, he told me that he had moved back in with the Latimers and had taken 2 months off work to grieve Caro. There was no mention of Angelica, who I assume had been cast off when it became obvious that she was a grifting snake trying to get into his pants. I assume she did, in fact, make it into that particular area before being unmasked. But then they do say that grief does funny things to people. And besides, Jim was channeling his sadness in a different direction. An upholstery course, as unlikely as it sounded. And I suppose that means we'll all be getting slightly wonky armchairs for Christmas. Caro's death wasn't for nothing, then. Even without the free furniture, her death wasn't for nothing. It meant no Caro. That was a blessing in itself. He ended the letter with a cliched passage about how he didn't expect me to forgive him. Why do people say this when just the mere fact that they've got in touch with you to say it means they clearly expect forgiveness? But he would spend the rest of his life trying to make it up to me and would be at the prison come the day of my release. Love you, Grey. I'll help you sleep again soon, he signed off. I wondered if Sophie would insist on coming along. desperate to make my story her own for currency, just as she did when I was younger. Perhaps we'd all go to the local bakery for a celebratory breakfast. Jimmy would inevitably forget his wallet, and Sophie would pay for us.